applaud my colleagues here because they've done such tremendous work in these respective areas, and they've worked very hard in really trying to promote evidence-based practice, evidence-based policy. And one thing that is fascinating here is this notion of disasters. And really, we're not there yet. There are many issues with disasters. We're really in our infancy and looking at this as a science. But we feel that it is a natural nexus between medicine and public health, and we're going to try and discuss this. But we're going to take a little bit of a different stance. We're actually going to talk a little bit about sort of the definitions and kind of how we're approaching it at the AMA, and then talk about the trends that are going on currently and how this really needs to feed into public health schools, medical schools, in terms of education and in terms of promoting leaders for tomorrow. So essentially in our definition, so when we go to a number of these different audiences, we are often asked, well, how do you define a disaster? What do you mean when you say disaster? There's many different meanings to many different people. But we want to get beyond a two-car crash here. We're looking at events that have regional consequence, that have economic consequence, and of course have significant public health impact that may potentially affect the GDP of a country or the GDP of a state. So when we look at preparedness and the terminology of preparedness, you'll find that there are at least 400 definitions of this out there. You'll find that some people use this term very frequently, but how people are using it among each other is a question that's debatable. Some folks believe that preparedness is a synonym of planning. Some people believe that preparedness encompasses four phases: planning, mitigation, response, recovery. From our vantage point at the AMA, we view disasters as a system. We view it as a continuous system, and we believe that when we look at preparedness in its totality, we have to look at it in a systems way, how things are interconnected, and in fact, in the regional sense, how we can build a disaster health system. This is something that actually very recently Homeland Security Presidential Directive number 21 was just recently passed, is actually looking at it in this exact light. So we believe that this is an area that as I said earlier is not something that there is a clear evidence base for. There is. In fact, 80% of most peer-reviewed publications in disasters occur in different specialty journals. There are about two or three specific journals that are dedicated to disaster medicine, public health preparedness, and you'll find, as I said, only about 20% actually occur there. But what is significant about disasters is that it does cut across all health professionals. It cuts across the entire health system. And the issue really is, in this one moment, in this moment of cataclysm, of catastrophe, we now have to talk to folks and collaborate with people whom we may never have collaborated with before, and whom we need to speak in a specific lexicon, something that, again, as I said earlier, is not necessarily well defined. And the reason we have to do that is because disasters by themselves, it's called a disaster because, unfortunately, people die, populations suffer, and we need to get to a sort of a scientific underpinning so that we can mitigate against any excess death, any excess injury that that may occur here from a disaster. One of the other reasons, many folks, again, many audiences that we come to give these talks, there's a talk. Is this just a fad? Is disasters a fad? We got a little bit of funding for it, and is this going to just kind of dissipate? But I did a fellowship in disaster medicine because I really believe that this is something that is not only an issue for now, but are going to become a much more increased issue going forward. And there are reasons for that, and we're going to talk about some of the trends that we're seeing. One of the trends is the issue of climate change, how climate change is impacting as far as natural disasters. Our natural disasters are increasing. The issue of globalization, this economic phenomenon that's bringing nations and worlds together, yet there are unintended public health consequences that occur, and certainly has increased risk for communicable disease as well as the risk of terrorism. So looking at just sort of natural disaster trends, I'm using a WHO database. It's the Crisis Resource Epidemiological Database, which comes actually out of Belgium. And so they have a database looking at all disasters. I'm going to focus here on natural disasters as they've defined it. So looking at the trends here, we see that since 1995 here, we have a significant doubling, almost an increased doubling of natural disasters. Some of this has been a function of perhaps underreporting, and now that we have globalization, now we got cell phones. You know, in Myanmar, Burma, when that revolution occurred, we may not have known about it 20 years ago, or perhaps we would have known about it, a month or two later. But now with an incredible cell phone device, we can take a picture of it and say, this is a horrible thing. So certainly there is an aspect of underreporting here, but most disaster specialists do believe there still has been a significant rise in terms of natural disasters. Another interesting trend is that, if it's not in the news, it's not happening. This notion that, okay, we've had Katrina, we've had the tsunami, we've had, all these events, but last year we didn't have any events. I mean, there was no major event last year, so why should we worry about this? Well, in fact, if you look epidemiologically at this, you'll find that there is essentially the same number of events occurred looking throughout the world. If you compare 2006 statistics to between 2000 and 2005. So these certainly are continuing to occur and, in fact, are potentially increasing. We talk about this bridge between medicine and public health. Why is this a natural bridge? Because when these disasters occur, they destroy the public health infrastructure. People, populations are impacted. I'm going to talk specifically, real quickly, briefly, about the California wildfires. But essentially, when we go out to a disaster, the first thing we do is a rapid needs assessment. And we look at health facilities. We look at the function of water and sanitation. This one was taken when I was in Pakistan doing some work there. But the point is, these are the similar kind of principles that we try to apply when we go to any disaster, including Katrina, including the California wildfires. So specifically, here you can see a fire line here, and you can see the homes there. I apologize, it's a bit blurry. But the point, nonetheless, is that this event occurred. It was a significant event in San Diego. But we have to applaud their efforts. They did a tremendous job between the state, between the local public health department, between the fire and EMS community. It really has been a tremendous, well played out response. And it's not by accident. It's not by accident. When the event occurred, we had we talked to these folks. We offered some modicum of assistance, if you will. But the reality is, they had these pieces in place long before since 2000. And perhaps this is a function of the wildfires that they continue to see out there. But some of the things that we are concerned about is they were able to evacuate 500,000 people. But where are they going? Where are these 500,000 people going? In fact, a small percentage, actually, compared to Katrina, of the 500,000, about 50,000, if you will, were actually in Red Cross shelters. And so the question is, if you've got temporary public health sheltering for these folks, again, these are just estimates, but if you have this sort of mass population out of sitting in a shelter, there are these great concerns about adequacy of food and water, adequacy of sanitation, adequacy of essentially immunization within the population. We are concerned about smoke and fire exposure, smoke inhalation, particularly particulate exposure, which has some significant long-term issues. When we spoke with some of these folks in San Diego, there was notion of surveillance, looking at hospital-based surveillance for respiratory and burn issues. One fascinating tool that the AMA has partnered with the American Pharmaceutical Chains of America is this thing called ICERx. And essentially, it is a tool when a population, when you have displaced folks from a disaster, they can and they don't remember their medical record. If they see a physician or a clinician, and they can offer their name and their most recent address, and we are able to pull up their medication record. that would certainly provide a physician an idea of what their previous medical history is. It's for free. There's no cost to it. It was a tool that was also employed for San Diego. As the folks were displaced, we made that tool available to physicians, medical reserve corps units, DMATs, folks that were responding to Katrina. One of the issues that we are doing with one of the big issues that I spoke about earlier is this notion of respiratory morbidity and mortality secondary to smoke and particulate exposure, long-term issues here, particularly in folks with pre-existing pulmonary disease. Another issue is mental health, and particularly the pediatric population. They have been, unfortunately, quite susceptible to such exposure, and I think we need to be very proactive with that. We are actively meeting with local stakeholders, the local medical society, the local public health department, the academic public health, San Diego State Public Health, American Lung Association, local chapters, and really trying to look at these issues in a community sense, in a community advocacy sense, to try and figure out what is the best way to actually kind of monitor this situation. Taking a step here, looking at globalization, we think this is a phenomenon, an economic phenomenon that has public health ramifications, which provides us, unfortunately, makes us increasingly vulnerable to communicable disease as well as to global threats of terrorism via the internet, bomb-making strategies, that sort of thing. If we look at the GDP of China at this time, 13.7, India 6.2, and we look at the projections into 2020, we see that their GDP 19.4, India 8.8, that Far East population now has individually more purchasing power. Has more ability to travel, is creating more goods and services. But if you're looking at 2005 to 2020, this is significant. This is an exponential spike. This is not a gradual industrial, revolution, if you will, in the setting of 50 to 60 to 100 years. We're talking about 15 years, and you're seeing this massive spike. So the issues of regulations, of standards, when you start building products, when you start using more world consumption for goods and services, you end up with a rapid industrialization, a need for increased energy, and you end up emitting more greenhouse gases. You end up having deforestation. So this is going to end up with with the notion of increased natural disasters. You also end up with this notion of a gold rush in these developing countries. You have urbanization, particularly urbanization overpopulation. You end up with these denser populations, with folks bringing in their, living closer to animals, bringing animals into the city. That is their livelihood. That's how they make a living. And so you now have greater exchange between denser populations. And, of course, these lead to greater increased risk for a pandemic. As well as talked about trade and commerce, we are seeing in Chicago, I was talking to the public health director in Chicago, the concerns of defective products, including the dolls that you see. You know, we see it on the news, but it's actually here. I mean, it's impacting us here. These are issues when you get lead-tainted dolls, when you get issues with toothpaste, as well as the notion of globalization. It's a great thing. We have a World Wide Web. We can disseminate ideas, ideologies, but we can also disseminate negative ideologies. I spoke about globalization and travel. Look at this. We're in 2007 here, about 770 million folks traveling. In 2017, the projection is almost 1 billion. I mean, this is, we talk about mixing of populations, something that is quite significant. Looking at infectious disease here, we've noted those points. When you have overpopulation, urbanization, you've got these greater risks, again, for infectious disease. One of the reasons we feel we need to have education is because our community, we sometimes look at the government and say, you're fear-mongering, you're always promoting fear. But we are actually just as culpable of that, promotion. We talk about pan flu, avian flu, and folks aren't appreciating the risk for what it is. And it's so important that we have proper education and leadership so that we can actually talk to people. Yes, there are concerns. Yes, we've seen the terrible, the epidemiological consequences of the Spanish flu, 40 million people. You look at the spike here in the 20 to 45 population. So that's significant. And we look at avian influenza, and yet we see very high mortality. And in fact, if you look at the cases that are being reported, it's similar. It's young and healthy. But there is no sustained human-to-human transmission yet. There has been none documented, really. The concern right now, and the fact is, we've got very, very increased surveillance for this particular bug. I think there is a real concern, really, for something such as SARS, something that we're not keeping an eye on that potentially could come back through the back door. But we just have to be a little bit more rational, particularly in the way we speak to folks, and I think that's part of the educational piece. As I said, passengers, we're looking at a significant increase in growth in Asia Pacific as well as Latin America, where we see most of these, we see some of these germs actually evolving from. This is fascinating with regards to global terrorism. This photo was from the 1950s here, when there was a proposal, an architectural proposal, to put this. The plans were just being created to create the Twin Towers, and they, you know, of course, you see the plane in that picture in the New York Times. So I just thought it was just fascinating. Sometimes we believe we could never perceive such a thing, but yet it's maybe there was some thought there. Yes, and the notion here of global terrorism, and we talked about internet being a way we can share ideologies. Ways that folks who in different countries, different continents, may never have been able to speak, but now can find a common ideological chat room, and you can easily disseminate certain strategies. So we believe in education. We believe in multidisciplinary education, multi-specialty education. We believe that all physicians have a specialty, and that is public health. And we think that it's significant that when we look at this, and we look at all the factors and all the folks that are involved in disaster response, health response, we need to have competency-based education that cuts across all these sectors. And if you look here, there's a blue here. And we feel there's a core competency that actually will cut across all health responders. And that's what we've been working at very hard here at the AMA, to define that core mission. And then as you go on to become a nurse, or you go on to become a specialist in chemical exposures or biological, you may have a different color, a different module. But if we need to have a common lexicon, we need to be able to talk in the same language. And so this is what we're proposing here. This is something that we've been working on with our National Disaster Life Support Educational Committee, where we have defined a set of competency domains, a set of core competencies that are going to define different levels of proficiencies, and therefore we can actually define an actual core level of core competency for all health responders. If you go on to become a practitioner or a leader, that is going to be a module that you are going to take further, if you will. We do have this educational program, the core, the basic, and the advanced. We welcome your involvement. We are now in the next evolution of these courses, and I know the APHA is actively involved, but the more, the better. We ask you to be part of our educational consortium. That consortium at this time has a group of 75 public and private stakeholders, and we intend to grow. Our next meeting will probably be in May of next year. And to finish up here, we've got a journal, a peer-reviewed publication that is, you may see their booth out there. We welcome your participation in terms of authorship. We welcome it in terms of reviewer and certainly subscriber. We hope that this is a forum where we will be able to build the evidence base, that we will be able to bring the disparate papers into one forum so that we can have a common dialogue and advance preparedness. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of concerns about the age of when certain immunizations are given. It also, there's a lot of concerns about which immunization it actually is. There's been a lot of focus on MMR specifically, that might be the cause. Of course, you don't get that until you're about 12 months of age. You know, but again, there's no data to show that there's any sort of or linkage between the two. You know, ACIP does, when they do review data of the effects of immunizations on different ages of kids and adults. You know, they're doing a lot of work on HPV to see if, you know, advancing it past the recommended age of 26 all the way up to 50 is going to be a good idea. ACIP is a pretty cautious group, so I have to say that they do actually look pretty carefully at the data for a long time before they would ratchet down and recommendation to give an immunization to a child as young as 6 weeks. So there's no data, but it's definitely something to look at. Yep, we're working at that too. trying to increase reimbursement along those lines across the board is really something that we're working at. At the federal level, that's something we work on for VFC as well as 317.
Any other questions? Yes. I can speak about one area, and then Itala, you might want to, and anyone else, please join in. We're working with a number of medical societies around the issue of healthy lifestyles. You talked about disasters before. Unhealthy lifestyles in this country are are the biggest public health disaster that we've got, causing huge number. I estimated yesterday 1.2 million deaths a year. We are working with them to get them involved. We're developing a toolkit on healthy lifestyles for them to get involved in counseling of patients around that, but we're also trying to get them involved in advocacy activities around this. So, for example, working on smoking policies in their states or their localities. But it's an uphill battle. I mean, as you know, docs are not trained in medical school about public health very much, and we need to do a lot more of that. As Italo said, and our previous president used to say, public health should be every doctor's second specialty. Italo, I don't know if you want to comment about the state medical societies.
We ended up doing a lot of work down in Katrina, working with the local medical societies as well as the state medical societies in conjunction with the public health departments. Disasters are an interesting way to really connect the two, really to try and get beyond parochialism, try and get beyond sort of pet rocks, and to look at a common endpoint. And bringing people to the table, we think talking about disaster preparedness is a way that we've tried to do that. We hope that our journal will promote a language, the language exchange that we're trying to see. We hope that our courses, the National Disaster Life Support Educational suite of courses that we're going to have, are going to actually be able to cut across that. We hope that that core that we talk about, that blue that we see on the Rubik's Cube here, we hope that that will provide at least at a minimum, some minimum common sort of language that folks in public health and medicine, that will be a bridge that will help cross that divide as well. But I recognize it's fascinating. When I went to San Diego for this for the wildfires, and we got the folks around the table, I was like, this is a great response, great job. It's fascinating to see that really so many of these folks don't get together before these kinds of events. And it's, you know, I understand your concern.
We have one more.
Yeah, I also just want to say that the state medical societies are actually the vehicle in which we go through for the continuing medical education and educate providers on the anti-pandemic vaccine. So I agree with sort of the natural way to sort of bridge the great work that the AMA is doing, supporting the state medical society to get into sort of the downhill stream. It may not be engaged in the public health initiative. I also work on some healthcare disparity reduction work as well, the Commission on Healthcare Disparity, which the AMA is a part of. Also, some of this workshop that was just commissioned the state medical society last week, actually, to do a workshop on educating providers around that issue. So I think the one thing that I'm saying in it somewhere, and I'm going to really approach that as well.
Sure. That's a good point. At the beginning, I showed the model with the overlap. I think it's very important that we do it that way. We currently have a proposal that will be going in this week to do something with the AMA working with the Chicago Medical Society, the Illinois Medical Society, and the Chicago Department of Public Health on a major public health initiative for Chicago. So I agree, it being partners is what it's all about.
Thank you.
Well, what you're indicating, and I agree, is that this system is totally broken. It is such a mess. That's not an official AMA line, but it's broken. We need to fix it. I could give you my personal opinion about what kind of transformation we need, but that would not be the official AMA line. But the AMA is also working to make sure, number one, that everybody is covered in this country. Two, we're working on things such as getting increased reimbursement for preventive services, because if you're not being paid for it, the odds are that you're not, if you're a provider, going to take the time, because there are such enormous pressures on providers today. I mean, I think we all need to work together to get a better healthcare system, and I think this upcoming presidential election will have a lot to do with how quickly we fix the system. But we need to fix it. There was one more question. Up until 2 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and I was there for 17 years. I had a lot of interaction with educators at other medical schools, and I will tell you, there is not a lot of public health training going on in most medical schools in this country. I think it's unfortunate. I think we need to fix that, but I guess we just have a disagreement in terms of that. I know pediatricians always feel, and they are at the forefront in terms of focusing on prevention, but relatively little time is spent in both medical student training and residency training focusing on public health issues, and I think we need to do a much better job of it. We thank you very much. Whoever has the petitions back there, if you could make sure that we get them, that would be terrific. Thank you very much for your attention.